It's one small step for man, one giant leap for mankind.
But the Krell forgot one thing, it. Monsters, Doc. Monsters from the id.
There you go again, always blaming me for everything.
Go switch off!
Exterminate!
It's a trap!
This looks extraordinarily bad.
Commencing countdown. T minus 5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Welcome to the Skiffany Fanny Show.
Pleasing Family Values with Leslie Chu.
I'm Sean.
I'm Paul.
And our special guest is Wes Chu.
Hello.
So real quick before we get started about the upcoming book, The Rebirths of Tao, you were nominated in the Campbell Award category, which is Hugo, not a Hugo, Hugo.
And you guys were nominated for Hugo.
This is correct.
Congratulations.
And congratulations to you as well.
Thank you.
So a little bit, you know, what was kind of your reaction to discovering that you were a Campbell Award nominee?
You know what? The email came at like 2 a.m. And I was actually hanging out with Brian McClellan.
Oh, okay.
So he came over from Cleveland, and we were just kind of chilling out. He doesn't drink. I was drinking a lot. And we're just kind of hanging out, and then the email popped in, and it took me a couple seconds to register that it was a Campbell nod. So it was a big deal for me.
Yeah, and it obviously is a reflection of your work, and we've spent a little bit of time with some of your previous two books, The Lives of Tao and The Deaths of Tao. And now you've got this last book. And I know earlier today we were talking about trilogies, and you yourself have written a trilogy and had mentioned it was rather difficult writing a trilogy for you. Could you talk a little bit about that process?
Oh, yeah. I mean, trilogies it was a tough slog for me because for me, you know, I'm finishing up Rowan's storyline, and what I did was, you know, in the first book, it was primarily his point of view. In the second book, I added two more points of view. And when you finish a trilogy, you gotta finish up everybody's storyline. So I ended up with, at one point, 5 points of view.
Ooh, wow.
You know, I mean, obviously some characters are more minor than others. So, but I wanted to make sure everybody's story was told. All the plot points were finished, and that, you know, the reader can finish reading the last book thinking, okay, you know, I'm comfortable leaving this world.
You're giving them closure.
All my answers have been resolved, you know. All my questions have been resolved. So.
And that you found that particularly difficult trying to tie everything together, just structuring a final book.
It's a pretty big world. And, you know, I probably didn't kill enough people. It seems I should have killed more people along the way, because I was like, there are a lot of people alive still that I need to finish their stories.
Yeah, I mean, the final book, we finally have this world that's split into factions, and I believe you have a someone who sort of becomes a spy and sort of goes to, I think he's on the Genjuk side. Remember that correctly?
The Genjuks are the bad guys.
Right, the bad ones. So you have this split, messed up world. So in fact, you do have a quite huge canvas to sort of resolve, because this is not a small piece. Could you talk a little bit about, you know, kind of developing this from the beginning? I mean, you sort of began in the beginning imagining this, this alien species that has lived on the Earth for centuries and centuries, and has kind of been like behind the scenes molding, but themselves have been split and kind of in a shadow war, as it were. And now we've got this very different sort of splitting, and it's much larger than perhaps it initially seemed, sort of the pathway to get to that point.
Well,
go.
So, I mean, when I first wrote, you know, The Lives of Tao, it was really, the war was almost like the background, you know.
Yeah.
It was, you know, it's all about Rowan and Tao and the relationship and Rowan's quest for self-improvement. When the second book came about, you know, I can't go back to that story about self-improvement. Now, it's kind of like, you know, I wrote in the on Scalzi's whatever page, but the big idea was I considered, you know, The Lives of Tao, Rowan, leveling up from 1 to 60. What do you do now when once your character's level 60? Well, you go raiding.
Yeah.
So I'm using Warcraft references now. So in The Deaths of Tao, I took him raiding. As you know, he's he's hit max level, and now we're going to go get some epic loots.
Okay, yeah, and I totally got detail wrong. I'm sorry. I don't know why I said spy. It was a defecting scientist is the appropriate detail. He defects from, I believe, the Genjix.
That's actually in the third book.
Right, no, that's what I meant. Yeah, that's what I was, yeah.
Okay, yes.
Yeah, we're previewing.
Yeah. Oh, you read the preview, yes.
Yeah, we do have obviously spying kind of going on in the first book for sure. And that's actually how the first book opens, when we talked about that a bit, about how Tao actually gets forced into Rowan's mind. Things go awry, as it were.
I mean, I will say this. I will say that in the third book, I resolve all my characters' plot points, but I don't fully resolve the war. Because for me, this war's been going on for 500 years now, and, you know, all the characters in the story are just cogs in the war. And the war's going to keep going on after. Because it's going to be one of those, it's the lives of Tao, and it's Rowan came in, made a contribution, has changed things, but, you know, it's still the process, because, you know, Tao's going to have more hosts after Rowan.
Yeah.
Yeah. That was something I was really curious about, because I really hooked on to the analogy that the lives of Tao was your Star Wars. We get the quote-unquote young Rowan Tao getting thrust into this long and old conflict, learning his powers as being bonded with Tao. And in the deaths of Tao, we get The Genji Strike Back, as I believe I said in my review.
You love that that analogy, because you brought it up to me like three times now.
I'm sorry, I've hooked onto this like a fish.
You're like, answer my question, Wes. Is it Empire Strikes Back? It is. It very much is the Empire Strikes Back.
So the question is Rebirth your Return of the Jedi?
In Return of the Jedi, they actually beat the Empire. Do they? I mean, yes. Technically,
they never it.
Yeah.
Yeah, they never talk about, at least in the films, they don't talk about what happens afterwards.
You know what I don't get? Okay, so they blow up the Death Star. Sure. Cool. But the rest of the galaxy still has the Empire. I mean, there's like, the Empire's still there.
Well, a lot of the Titan novels show that after that, there's whole bunch of, like Admiral Thrawn and a whole bunch of Imperials do cause a problem, but killing off the Emperor, who had singularly consolidated power into himself, kill him and you destroy the Empire. Empire, what comes out of it? Well,
bunch of warlords.
You do get quite a lot of that in the extended universe of people trying to bring back the Empire when it's in shambles. But one of the things I think it's oddly hilarious about the prequels is they actually address trade and economics, which has never been talked about. And it's like, when you think about it, a Death Star is not cheap. And the Empire has lost two. I mean, economically, that Empire must be about to collapse.
Can I ask, how did they build a second Death Star so quickly?
Because they finished the first, so they had... So
they had the plans.
They already had the plans.
It's still the size of a moon!
It is.
It's the size of the moon, and it was a lot faster. My personal headcanon is they were building the second while they were still finishing the
first. Right, like a backup. And nobody knew about it.
Because they've been
A backup Death Star.
Yeah.
We bought two of everything, so I might as well.
Have you never seen Contact?
Contact was exactly what I was thinking about.
Yeah, exactly. We could build two for twice the price.
And I imagine if they just started a little bit afterwards, they'd be like, yeah, we should probably not do that exhaust port thing. That'd be a good idea.
Design flaw. Let's cap it with like a turret or something.
Yeah, let's make sure that can't happen next time. But it's a really interesting question, because of course the ending of Star Wars is not actually about, you know, what really happens to the Empire. It's about the heroes succeeding and these smaller subplots. And maybe it is a good analogy to talk about your own work, as you've noted that. You're not, like, cleaning up the war. The war is not like, poof, it's done, and everything's fishy at the end. Or not fishy, but happy, right? That you're fixing up, you're cleaning up your character subplots, but the sort of larger plot, only pieces of that are maybe being sort of put to rest.
Well, I mean, this is very much the story of Rowan and his family. I have some plans to write a new trilogy in the same universe sometime down the line. And it would be more science fiction, because it would be in the future at this point, and it would be with new character and with a new quasi.
Oh wow, so this is something you're definitely thinking about.
I would like to, yeah.
Yeah. It's gonna happen.
I hope so.
It'll happen. This one's gonna sell like 5,000 copies. I don't know how much that is in publishing terms. Just add some more zeros on it.
Yeah, we need to add more.
Yeah, you're ambition, so.
You would sell 5,000 copies.
That sounds like I'll many. Like,
chirp. There's a cricket. I'm like, thanks, dude.
One of the interesting things I liked in the first two novels is the interlacing of history and historical events. I'm curious, since you've been writing through this entire trilogy, how many of those events did you, quote unquote, know in advance when you were plotting out the trilogy, and how many came and arose naturally and organically as you were developing Rowan and Taos and Gendrick's history for that matter? Because they overlap in time. You keep bopping back and forth in the first two novels, and I assume is the third similar that way. Do we get to see more flashbacks to history?
Well, okay, so the first part of the question, when I first started writing Lives of Tao, the only historical scene that I wanted to put in was Genghis Khan, which initially was an entire chapter. Like, I actually wrote out like Genghis Khan's life in one chapter, and then Angry Robot asked me to actually turn those chapters into summaries. So originally I had 8 chapters of Tao's story. And I ended up picking them out, pulling them out, and turning them into the historical pieces in the beginning of every chapter. So I had Genghis Khan and I had Tai Chi. Because the story of Tao, you know, inventing Tai Chi was actually based off of a real legend about how, like, you know, this guy named Chang Sanfen saw a magpie and a snake fight and kind of like figured out how they were flowing back and forth and kind of developed Tai Chi from studying them.
Oh, fascinating.
So I actually had that. Those are the two things I wanted to put in the book. And when I started researching, you know, it's like, how do you, you know, Tao needs to get from, you know, the Mongolia to China to learn Tai Chi. Then when did they get back west? So I actually had to research and fill in the blanks on his path over, like, you know, 800 years.
Okay. So, I mean, kind of coinciding with the actual history as we know it.
Right.
Sort of, yeah.
And then in the Rebirths, I changed the historicals up a little bit. One of the major plot lines goes through some historical pieces.
Mm-hmm.
But the other two, one of the, explores the more recent past that explores the gap in between books 2 and 3. And the third historical explores the history of the Kwazing before they went to Earth.
Oh, nice.
That I'm sounds excited. Exciting. Yeah, because we don't actually know much about them.
You will learn exactly what kind of alien they are, and it will be surprising.
Ooh. Okay. That sounds great. Yeah, because before, I mean, the series thus far is, I mean, what we know is mostly their terrestrial, Earth-based life to some degree. I mean, obviously you haven't like sat down and written like a 500,000 word history yet, but we get pieces of that through their own narrative, this war and the conflict between the two factions. So that's actually really interesting that you've decided to actually inject these this additional history that goes back even further into their own past, not just our past, but theirs. So out of curiosity, why did you decide to kind of explore their history even before they came to Earth?
Because once you know more about the Kwazing, you'll know exactly where they came from in terms of, you know, how their approach to Earth is different from what you think it is. I can't give too much away because, sure. You know, but it also sets things up for the future, for future books.
Oh, okay.
So, I mean, I eventually, you know, mankind, we are going to leave Earth and we are going to, you know, start colonizing and, you know, have moon bases and have, you know, asteroid mining and everything. And I want to move the series further into the future so that maybe eventually they will encounter other Kwazing.
That's very interesting. So taking it from a near future-y, well, maybe not quite near future, but
contemporary
SF to almost like a space opera.
It's going to head that direction. So in the next, if I'm fortunate enough to write, you know, Tao 4 through 6, the next trilogy, you know, it actually wouldn't be even Tao. It'd be the lives of whatever the Kwazing's name is. It will be probably, you know, 30, 40 years from this series, and then we'll just see how far I can go.
That sounds really, really exciting.
Yeah, that kind of reminds me a little bit of some of those extending from on Earth into the future histories of from Pineline all the way up to CJ Cherry and building and extending and building out that world. That's really exciting. I mean, and I'm on board for that idea because there's not enough science fiction in writing these days. I mean, fantasy seems to be the 800-pound gorilla and science fiction seems to be the weak 90-pound weakling.
Is that what it is? Am I playing on the underdog team right now?
I think you are.
A little bit. I mean, I would say that science fiction is not, I think science fiction does really well in tie-in.
It's cyclical. Yeah, I think it's cyclical, you know. I think, you know, science fiction is much bigger, you know, maybe 15 years ago, and now it's fantasy, and it's going to come back and forth, you know.
Absolutely.
Like we talked about earlier during lunch, James S. A. Corey's Expanse series is going to be a big deal because, you know, Sci-Fi Channel is going to put a lot of money into it, and they're going to make a great space opera out of it, and it's might be the next Game of Thrones in space, and before you know it, the sci-fi will be back.
Yeah, and I think that what's going to be so also exciting about that is it'll on the one hand it'll draw attention to their books, obviously a whole audience who probably went on when they watched Battlestar to read some of the tie-in novels. They're now going to go read, well, this is based on real books, and go read those, and of course that's going to lead to, well, but there are these other books that are like these books. You can try those, so it could have a big impact on things like space.
Rising tide lifts all boats,
and writers saying, "Hey, people are reading and watching science fiction on this week, saying maybe I should write some more. Maybe we can get." Authors more interested in the science fiction side of things.
Yeah. Well, Lord of the Rings was probably a big reason why, you know, everybody reads epic fantasy these days, because the movies came out and everybody was like, this is awesome and I need to read more of this stuff. So,
yeah, I mean, it's certainly in the same way that had an influence on the rise of contemporary epic fantasy, probably had an influence when they made them into movies.
Yeah, exactly.
I mean, the same way that The Hobbit probably is having some influence as well, since The Hobbit movies are not really The Hobbit anymore. They're sort of like Lord of the Rings 2.
And I think that's a deliberate thing.
It is, off
topic.
I do not get how he turned... I mean, The Hobbit's not a big book. I mean, it's a tiny book. And it's three movies that's like 10 hours long.
He's doing an expanded version of The Hobbit, mixed in with elements of the Silmarillion and a lot of other things. So it's a Hobbit really, and only name.
I mean, I understand what he was trying to do when he was probably forced against his will to make three movies.
Was he forced against his will to make three movies?
I got a feeling that he said like, we could do this in two, and then the studios are like, no, you need to do three again, because we need $1 billion. I mean, that's what I feel like, because there's a sense of with these movies that they're really being stretched very thin in parts.
Well, I mean, in the first movie, how long were the Doors having dinner in his place?
It was 45 minutes long. It's like there's a random song. I know it's in the book, but get to the song sooner. They're like throwing plates around and like, you know, it's, oh, come on. I mean, I get that there's a sort of repeat from the original Lord of the Rings, because in the beginning of Lord of the Rings, it's like Gandalf, he shows up, and he, like, shoots his fireworks, it's a big party, but we learn in that process there's the ring, and there's some weirdness going on, and Gandalf, there's mystery there. And then when that finally gets revealed...
There's purpose in having those scenes.
Right, you know, sort of normal life, and then mystery and weird stuff, where this, it's like... The mystery is, why are these dwarves showing up at his house? You know, Gandalf is like, look, why is Gandalf being an ass? Because that's what he's doing. He's like, this hobbit just wants to be left alone. I just want to eat my sausage.
Gandalf is kind of a dick.
He is. I don't understand. How is nobody going, Gandalf, like, you're such a jerk.
I'm the granddaughter I want.
Yeah.
Because he's one of the Astari and he wears the ring of power. That's why no one says he's a jerk. Because, well... He's a badass.
Yeah, and there's a missing component, I think, to those opening scenes. You know, the real mysteries and major plots really don't have anything to do with The Hobbit.
Right.
Whereas in Lord of the Rings, like, the Ring of Power has everything to do with the Hobbits because A, one Hobbit has it, and B, the other Hobbit has to be the bearer now. So that's part of the big reveal. This is like, this Hobbit's just getting dragged along.
Okay, and my problem with the whole first movie especially is, you know, at the very end, you know, the Rock comes and picks them all up and takes them like halfway there.
Yeah.
And my thing is, well, why didn't you just get the Rocks to begin with?
I get that question because it's a really good question for anyone who's not a Tolkien nut.
I'm not a Tolkien nut, by the way.
Yeah, it is a great question. If you're not a Tolkien nut and you're never going to be a Tolkien nut, that's the best question you ever ask because it makes no sense. If you are a Tolkien nut, you're just going, oh, well, they're like this, their own species, or they
have species,
their own...
They're spirits, they're spirits of the world, and that's not right. What they do. They provide comfort and succor, but only to a point.
Right. They have their own thing going on. It's sort of, yeah.
Well, why didn't they bring in the whole entire way then?
Well, they don't, my understanding is they don't get involved in, like, petty human affairs unless it affects them, because they don't really care about what other people
are doing. Well, they picked them up from the tree.
From a narrative point, I can tell you why, and I'm going to evoke Heinlein again.
Oh, God.
I'm sorry, Glory Road. Have you read it? Either you read it?
No.
Okay, I'm going to spoil Glory Road for the listeners. And Glory Road is Heinlein trying to deconstruct fantasy circa 1962.
Okay.
And at one point he realizes he's been dragged around this fantasy world trying to get to a certain portal, and then he gets there, and then he realizes they could have just snapped from A to B and not gone through there, and he even asks the love of his life and the woman dragging on. I said, well, why didn't we just take the shortcut? It would have been so much faster. He said, you wouldn't have been ready for the tower. You'd have laughed it off and have been killed in 5 minutes. If you took Bilbo and dragged him all the way to the mountain, he wouldn't have been ready to face Smaug. He'd been toast.
Wait a minute. But that's not what Gandalf was thinking. He's like, all right, guys, I'm going to put you guys through a couple tests. And then after you've died times and bled and killed
yes,
at least 40 orcs, then we're ready to go.
Oh, yes, he is, because he is a thief. He is or will be when the time comes. He's expecting to try to level up Bilbo on this trip across.
Maybe.
The dwarves don't need leveling up. Bilbo does, because Bilbo needs to be the...
But that doesn't make any sense for the Lord of the Rings trilogy, when the birds literally could have just taken them. He would not have been affected by the ring yet, right?
I can't defend. I'm just discussing
Frodo isn't. He isn't affected by the ring until he's had this damn thing for however long he's been walking around.
And what do they need about Aul again? Because he's a thief?
In The Hobbit, he's not actually a thief. That's what Gandalf says.
He's just sneaky.
Yeah.
I mean...
Well, his argument is that hobbits are very sneaky, and...
Couldn't you get a real thief? But like, yo, you're a professional thief. We could use you for this job. Well, I'll just pay you a sack of gold, and let's do it.
I think his argument is that... His fascination with hobbits is that nobody expects hobbits to be up to no good. They just kind of hang out, drink beer, and have a good time.
Do orcs care though? Is that like
orcs probably don't? But
the dragon.
But if a human thief, right, you know, skulking around all shadowy looking, goes into Smaug's chamber, Smaug is not going to toy around with him. A hobbit does, and it's like, really?
I'm pretty sure Smaug tried to just eat him no matter what.
Yeah, but Smaug was toying with him for a while because, like, I don't know what you are.
Right, he's really fascinated by this little short little man who has the audacity to walk into this place.
Yeah,
whereas if it's like, you know, a dwarf.
If you walked in, you'd be dead.
I don't know. I think Gandalf overthought the whole thing.
I think we're overthinking the entire Hobbit.
You may be right.
We're off on a tangent. So.
We are. I don't know how to relate that back to your book.
Because they're both awesome. I'm just going to go to a randomly different question. One of the things I really liked about The Lives of Tal that you did, and I wanted you to speak to this, is that, especially with the historical narratives and also with the present day narratives in first The Lives and in The Deaths, your use of Asian settings and Asian history and developing your characters, and I wanted you to speak to why you decide to make the less obvious choices to have Tal go through Genghis Khan and the life of the founder of Tai Chi rather than making him a Charlemagne or something.
Because Genghis Khan's a badass and Tai Chi is badass, and it's like Rowan Tan is purposely, I mean, he's Asian.
Uh-huh.
But I don't, you know, project, oh, his Asian-ness in the story. My whole thing is, I grew up wanting to see Asian protagonists without them having to act or be Asian. So for them, he just happened to be the main character who just happened to be Asian. And I like that. And I think, what Tao did, you know, exploring, going through Asia, through Genghis Khan, and being the first, you know, being the first Ming emperor, it was just his path, you know. I didn't want to accentuate, oh, you know, he's doing this because he's, you know. I want to have an Asian setting without punching me in the face about how Asian it is.
Sure.
And that's something that, again, has been raised at one of the panels, when I was on a diversity panel, and that was one of the things that, was raised, is the idea that, we don't always have to, make exceptional our non-white male characters, you know, whatever is our diverse character we've gone for, that sometimes the better path is just, like, there's people, and they're just different.
Exactly.
And whatevs, they're all gonna go play Warcraft or whatever.
There's especially on television these days, when there's an Asian character, he's either like, you know, I'm the lab tech, or I'm tech support, or, you know, he's Asian for a reason, and that drives me nuts.
Right, instead of just, like, he just happens to be an Asian guy, whatever.
Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, even sometimes, you watch Sleepy Hollow, perchance? No? Okay. For the most part, Sleepy Hollow is excellent. It handles, I mean, its cast is almost entirely, African American. It has one guy who's a white British man, who's one of the main characters. But otherwise, it's fairly good. Except one episode when they actually go, and deal with a Native American myth, and they have to go to a Native American guy to basically get his help. And it's super stereotypical, and anybody who's watched Westerns is, like, very familiar with this kind of stuff because it gets repeated, and it's the same thing. It's this one time when this series has failed because, of course, his whole purpose is he's just there as sort of this plot point, like Native American man doing quote-unquote Native American stuff, and then that's how we solve the mystery. Instead of, like, this is a real character who happens to be Native American and happens to have knowledge that they don't have, maybe because he happens to live on the reservation, or maybe because of some other reason. Maybe he went to school and he researched. Whatever. But they just sort of really essentialize and play up this sort of Native American-ness.
Right.
I put in quotey things.
I mean, I do admit, I trained in Tai Chi and Bagua, and there's a lot of Kung Fu. So it was a good way for me to write about what I know as well.
Sure.
So.
I want to take Kung Fu.
And the martial arts and that training of Rowan is one of the delights of The Last Dying, and seeing the dark side, and seeing how he's reacting and learning from almost from a social perspective that Enzo's developing. He's learning that his bullheadedness doesn't quite work, and I really enjoyed that little thread working through. Like, there's this classic, like, don't do it this way, you idiot, and he does it anyway, and he pays prices. He gets results, but I'm hoping that the seeds of the stuff he's done is going to bite him in the butt in the third one, or is that spoilery to say?
I really like Enzo. Here's the thing: I like complicated villains, and, you know, I've never been a fan of, like, I am evil for evil's sake. You know, the whole Sauron thing where I'm a big eye and I'm just here to make everybody's life miserable because that's what I do. You know, I like that he's, you know, frighteningly, he's great at so many things, but he's also so flawed at so many things. And he's an asshole, but he gets stuff done. You know,
yeah.
I like having these layers to peel back with my villains. You know, I want smart villains. I want smart and able villains who aren't just, like, brainless orcs that just are here to either eat you or to, you know, enslave you.
Yeah, smart and able villains are much more satisfying to defeat.
Yes.
Yeah, and equally so, villains who have motivations that even if you don't agree with them, you understand them. Yeah.
I get a lot of people who say, you know, I don't know if they're getting to really the bad guys.
That's a good thing to be raised.
We do learn in the second books now for a while, the Profics are not exactly all white hats.
Yeah.
I was using air quotes before about bad guys, about the Genjis, but the Profics have done some not so questionable things themselves. I mean,
both sides have done good and bad things, and, you know, because their objective is not to be good or to be bad. Their objective is to get stuff, you know, get what they want.
Hmm.
And we might identify, you know, I might have set up the factions to have one guy that's gooder and one guy that's badder, but really, they're both pretty gray.
Hmm. That's actually an interesting thing, since we're talking about a scenario in which they've been at war for hundreds and hundreds of years, it seems like, you know, to have this just be easily, like, good, like, black and white or good versus evil, sort of misses the fact that in any kind of war, it's like, even during something like World War II, which everyone thinks is very much is just good versus evil. Well, I mean, there's all these instances of the Allies firebombing entire cities and, you know, like, just raising stuff to the ground, which we recognize as maybe useful to finish the war. I don't know. I don't know all about the firebombings, but of course we recognize morally or questionable choices.
I mean, there's also context of, like, how we got into a situation. You know, I mean,
yeah.
World War One happened, and you know, after the war, the Allies could really, and the Allies really wanted to take it to Germany. You know, you guys lost the war, so we're going to make you pay.
Yeah.
And they basically set Germany up, you know, for the rise of the Reich, because the Germans were so, you know, disenfranchised by what's happening to, you know, a whole generation of Germans were disenfranchised.
Yeah.
And the same thing happened, you know, in Japan, where, you know, gunboat diplomacy came, and suddenly Japan's like, oh my gosh, we, you know, what is this, you know, advanced technology that the Westerners have? We must do something to prepare for this in the future. So they become very imperialistic because of that. So there, I mean, there's some back and forth involved with everything.
Yeah. Yeah, it's a very interesting thing and to have that be presented in your own work is really, I think that's adds a sense of realism, I think.
Yeah, another dimension to the text, yeah.
Thank you.
So A+.
Awesome.
Yeah, you get the plus.
A+.
A+. So, okay, we're at about, technically at about 30 minutes recording time. So do we want to take a moment? So I know it's a while for Rebirths to come out. You said it's
December 31st.
31st, okay. So we got a little bit of time for that. By the time this goes up, there'll still be a little bit of time left. But really quick, tell people where they can find you and, you know, obviously where they can find your work, which would be probably the same place they can find you.
You can find me at WesleyChu.com. My Twitter handle is Wes_Chu. And in Chicago, if you're ever in the area.
Okay, so you're in Chicago.
Yeah, he's Chicago.
I am from Chicago.
Will you be at Worldcon?
Go Bears. I will be at Worldcon this year.
Then we will see you.
And I'll see you, I'll be at World Fantasy too.
Oh, that's World Fantasy this year.
DC.
DC, okay. Unfortunately, I can't go to that one.
Where are you guys based at?
I'm in Florida.
I'm local.
Houston.
Oh, nice.
Yeah. So I live in a horrible place, but that's
Is it horrible? Well, Florida, where in Florida?
Gainesville.
Okay.
It's inland. I'm not near an ocean.
I don't know. I went to Orlando once and it was humid as all.
Oh, yeah, heck. That's Gainesville too.
I remember I walked out of an airport and there was like a wall of humidity. It like just punched me in the face.
It's very humid. Yeah.
Walls of humidity punching West 2 in the face.
Yeah, that'll be the tagline for your new book that comes after this one. I'm sorry, not for Rebirths, because that wouldn't make a whole lot of sense. But you should write like a humidity sci-fi story.
I do have one about my tour book. We'll look at that later.
Okay.
At a later point.
All right. Well, in any case, thanks, Paul, for joining me on this episode.
This is a pleasure. I love Wes's work.
And thank you very much, Wes, for your
thanks
time.
Thanks for having me.
Cool. And on that note, awkward ending. And scene.
If you would like to send us hate mail on this episode or any other topics we've covered, you can do so in a number of ways. You can send us an email.
SkiffyandFanty@gmail.com.
You can send us a tweet.
@SkiffyandFanty.
Leave a comment on the blog.
SkiffyandFanty.com.
Go to Google+.
Shawnee Jen.
And or Facebook.
The Skiffy and Fanty Show. Our intro music comes from Time Flux by Revolution Void. You can check them out at freemusicarchive.org.
You're just another weak human afraid to face death.
Heart in your general direction.
France, different planet.
The Force will be with you, always.
End of line.